Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The head of the International Monetary Fund endorsed Tuesday Nigeria's efforts to tackle corruption while saying the country needed to reduce its reliance on oil, sharp falls in the price of which have crippled its country. Speaking after talks with President Muhammadu Buhari, the IMF Managing Director, Christine Lagarde, also said she was not in Nigeria to negotiate alone. She spoke to reporters at the presidential villa and the capital of Abuja and said she backed what she called Buhari's important fight against corruption.
But what I certainly mentioned to Mr. President this morning was that his fight and his determination to fight corruption and his determination to bring about transparency and accountability at all levels of the economy were very important agenda item and very ambitious goal that need to be delivered upon, which he himself is definitely committed to, as he indicated this morning.
Again, that is the IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde speaking in the capital of Abuja, Nigeria. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced a series of new common sense measures meant to reduce gun violence by passing Congress on an issue that sharply divided the American public.
We're also taking steps to make the background check system more efficient. Under the guidance of Jim Comey and the FBI, and our Deputy Director, Tom Brandon, ATF, we're going to hire more folks to process applications faster, and we're going to bring an outdated background check system into the 21st century.
That's the president speaking at the White House. This is VOA News. Peace talks between Burundi's government and opposition groups have been postponed with no word on when they may resume. The talks opened in Uganda late last month and were set to continue Wednesday in Arusha, Tanzania. But a senior official in Burundi's Foreign Affairs Ministry said Tuesday that the government will not participate due to the inclusion of those whom he said are supporting violence. The Ugandan president, Yoweri Museveni, is attempting to mediate an end to Burundi's political crisis, triggered by President Pierre Nkurunziza's announcement last April that he would seek a third term. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said Tuesday that Saudi Arabia cannot hide its crime of executing a Shiite cleric critical of the Riyadh kingdom by severing its diplomatic ties with Tehran. Riyadh executed the cleric last weekend and then cut its diplomatic links with Tehran after demonstrators stormed Saudi diplomatic missions in Iran in protest of the killing. The Iranian government said the diplomatic split with Saudi Arabia will have no impact on Iran's national development. Tehran's latest reaction to al-Nimr's execution came as Kuwait joined other Saudi allies in taking diplomatic action against Iran. The move follows decisions by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Sudan to cut diplomatic ties with Iran, while the United Arab Emirates downgraded its relations with the country. The new United Nations figures reveal the terrible toll the ongoing conflict in Yemen is taking on civilians. The UN Human Rights Office reports more than 8,100 civilians killed or wounded between March 26 and the end of last year, the vast majority from airstrikes by Saudi-led coalition forces. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville notes the ceasefire agreed to by the warring parties before the start of the talks was broken within minutes. He says airstrikes have continued into the new year, with around 11 strikes taking place in the capital Sana'a this week and continuing into Tuesday.
We've not yet been able to confirm whether or not these latest strikes have resulted in more civilian casualties, although initial reports indicate several private and public civilian buildings have been hit since Sunday.
The UN Refugee Agency reports about 2.5 million people are internally displaced, and 167,000 have fled Yemen to surrounding countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
French President François Hollande Tuesday kicked off the week of commemorations marking Islamic extremist attacks in Paris that began with an assault on the satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo, a kosher market, and police a year ago this week, claiming 17 lives. The January 7, 2015 attacks, dubbed France's 9/11, marked the start of a string of jihadist strikes across the country that culminated in Paris with 130 dead. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
On the surface, it seems as though race relations are very poor in South Africa. There's a lot of antagonism, a lot of anger, a lot of old wounds are being reopened, and all of this is bubbling up on the surface of society at the moment.
That's Delia Robertson reporting on South Africa race relations. We'll have more on this story coming up. Also in the news, Burundi peace talks have been postponed indefinitely. We'll look at the array of opposition groups who were scheduled to attend those talks in Arusha. And the bodies of 21 migrants and refugees washed ashore today as boats capsized trying to reach the Greek island of Lesbos. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Nigeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Burundi peace talks have been postponed indefinitely. That word today from Tanzania's foreign minister. The talks were to begin tomorrow in Arusha. The announcement followed a statement from a spokesman for Burundi's foreign minister that the government would not attend the talks. The negotiations between the government and opposition parties were being mediated by the Ugandan government. Months of violence have followed the decision by President Pierre Nkurunziza to run for a controversial third term in office. Meanwhile, the French news agency says a former Burundi defense minister and four other defendants have pled guilty in a Bujumbura courtroom to involvement in a coup attempt last May. Well, the array of opposition groups that were scheduled to attend the Burundi mediation talks in Arusha this week included Burundi exiles, former military officers, civil society activists, former politicians, and some who are accused of plotting to overthrow President Pierre Nkurunziza. One opposition party, however, had not been invited. NARED says the government does not want to negotiate because it knows it's the cause of the current problems. VOA's David Arnold talked with Philip Clark of the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London about delegations that were scheduled to attend the talks.
Several of them are former military leaders in Burundi. Many of them would have been considered to be middle-level political actors until they went into exile and were able to, in many ways, empower themselves by being based in Rwanda. That's certainly one of the criticisms that has been leveled against the delegations. So this will continue, I think, to be a difficult issue for these mediation talks, that the legitimacy of these so-called opposition leaders.
What about people then who remain in Burundi? Would they be more legitimate opposition leaders for negotiation?
There is a collection of opposition parties still based inside of Burundi that could play a much more constructive role in this process. And in particular, I think leaders from a party like the FNL, which historically has been quite closely aligned with Nkurunziza's government, but in recent times have become somewhat more critical of the government. I think that is a party that could start to have some influence over Nkurunziza and his policy. They're seen as a party that can build a close dialogue with Nkurunziza. In many ways, they speak his political language. It's an opposition group like that that may turn out to have much more impact over what's happening in Burundi than the kind of opposition parties that have gone into exile in the last few months. And so certainly Nkurunziza, I think, is angry that a group like the FNL has not been included in the talks in Entebbe.
What do they oppose about the Nkurunziza regime?
In particular, they oppose Nkurunziza running for a third term. So in that sense, they hold a very similar position to many of the other opposition political parties. But what they don't oppose is many aspects of Nkurunziza's economic and political program up until the middle of last year. So he certainly raised concerns about their absence from the Uganda talk.
If the FNL is a legitimate opposition party operating in Burundi, would they have credibility with opposition in exile?
This has been one of the real problems in Burundian politics in the last 4 or 5 years, is just how much infighting there is amongst the opposition parties and how fragmented that the opposition has been. It has historically been a Hutu-dominated rebel group. It's only in the last 4 or 5 years that it is tried to transform itself into a political party. It in fact fought many of the other Burundian political parties when they themselves were also rebel groups. And even as recently as 3 years ago, the FNL was accused of continuing its rebel activity and was accused of killing civilians in a couple of very high-profile attacks. So for all of those reasons, it hasn't been able to build very close relations with other opposition groups, and in particular the opposition groups that have now gone into exile. And that's the main reason why it's been excluded from the talks. I think the only way that they could get a foothold in this process would be if the Burundian government basically threatens to walk out of the talks if the FNL are not included.
It sounds like these negotiations this week will not succeed.
I think one of the big stumbling blocks is this question over the opposition parties being palatable to the Burundian government. But the other sticking point is, of course, that the African Union's threat to send 5,000 peacekeepers to Burundi. The AU's move has been supported by the Burundian opposition in exile and also by all of the regional governments who are involved in this mediation process. The Burundian government has said that if the AU continues to threaten to send these peacekeepers, that it will no longer take part in the mediation. The Burundian government has also said that if the AU sends the peacekeepers, they will attack those AU forces. So that's the second big issue that's hanging over that process, and that doesn't look as though it will be resolved anytime soon.
It sounds like there are serious leadership issues among the opposition outside and inside the country.
There has been an attempt to form effectively an opposition coalition amongst a range of actors who are based in the diaspora. The Council for the Restoration of the Arusha Agreement and the Rule of Law, it's the CNARED, NARED, and they were formed in Brussels in August of last year. They have sent a delegation, and this is another group that Nkurunziza's government is opposing the involvement of in the talks. The main reason being that it also includes some former presidents of Burundi, various civil society leaders. This is as close as we've seen to any kind of broad-based opposition movement against Nkurunziza's government. As we've mentioned already, one of the biggest problems has been fragmentation in the opposition ranks. NARED has been a very rare example of different parties, different groups trying to come together to build some sort of coherent opposition movement. And Nkurunziza is extremely angry at the participation of NARED in the Entebbe talks. So that's a kind of a new development, I guess. We've seen a lot of coverage on the opposition in exile in places like Rwanda, but there's been, I think, a lot less discussion of the involvement of European-based diaspora groups. It's a little unclear so far exactly how effective they might be, but that is a kind of a new development in all of this.
That was Philip Clark, a scholar of comparative and international politics at the University of London. He spoke with VOA's David Arnold. The bodies of 21 migrants washed ashore today as boats capsized, trying to reach the shores of the Greek island of Lesbos. Seven passengers have been rescued. Local officials in the coastal town of Avalik told a Turkish news agency they were continuing the search for survivors, but said the death toll could rise. In an unrelated event, officials in Istanbul report that Turkish police have arrested 11 suspected smugglers in Izmir, Hatay, Kasaye, and Mugla. They are being charged with smuggling and negligent homicide. An estimated 850,000 migrants and refugees crossed into Greece last year, paying smuggling gangs to ferry them from Turkey in frail boats. Hundreds have lost their lives during the crossings. The International Organization for Migration says 3,771 migrants have died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea to Europe last year. The IOM calls it the deadliest on record for migrants crossing the Mediterranean. The IOM says 77% of the deaths were on the Central Mediterranean route, involving people crossing largely from Libya. IOM's final tally for those who arrived in Europe by sea last year was over 1 million people. Also, Danish officials say 18 people without proper ID have been refused entry from Germany in the first 12 hours of increased border crossing checks. Top officials from Denmark, Sweden, and Germany say they will hold talks in Brussels tomorrow amid concern about new border control measures aimed at stopping migrants entering Northern Europe. The meeting was called after Sweden introduced ID checks on all people traveling to Denmark, and Denmark tightened border controls on its border with Germany. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on 16 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. A spokesman for Burundi's foreign minister says the government will not attend peace talks scheduled for Wednesday. And the bodies of 21 migrants have washed ashore today as boats capsized trying to reach the shores of the Greek island of Lesbos. Seven passengers have been rescued. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. It's been 25 years since the end of apartheid in South Africa and the birth of multiracial democracy, but racial tensions in South Africa remain high. Recently, a tweet by an official of the mostly white Democratic Alliance Party triggered an uproar when she used a slur to describe blacks allegedly littering a beach. Reporter Delia Robertson is following developments from Johannesburg. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about the state of racial relations in South Africa.
On the surface, it seems as though race relations are very poor in South Africa. There's a lot of antagonism, a lot of anger, a lot of old wounds are being reopened, and all of this is bubbling up on the surface of society at the moment. On one level, however, race relations, if you go around your daily business and meet with people in the street and at work and et cetera, often race relations seem to be fine, and generally people are able to reach out to each other on a one-to-one basis. But at the same time, there are incidents of racism that exacerbate any feelings of anger and any hurt.
There has been a particular story in South Africa that's raising a lot of anger, and it's because of a tweet by a white member of the Democratic Alliance Party. Can you summarize what happened there?
The beaches in South Africa, as I think are beaches in most sunny climes on New Year's Day, were full of people. And given South Africa's demographic, where the population is about 80% black, most of the beaches were filled with black people, as one might expect. But this is, of course, different to what happened in the apartheid past, when most beaches were reserved for whites. So some white South Africans don't like a crowd, don't like being crowded in by black people. Some feel they can't go to the beaches because black people don't want them there. And Penny Sparrow sent a tweet in which she referred to black people as monkeys, picking up and dropping rubbish and not taking care of the place when they leave.
And what was the reaction to that?
Well, the reaction was outrage. It was all over Facebook. It was all over Twitter. And people were extremely angry. And she wasn't the only one. There were a couple of other people, including a senior economist at the Standard Bank who has since been suspended. He was talking about black entitlement and a growing number of victims. And this has caused outrage, as you can imagine. In Twitter, especially, there are a lot of black Twitterati, a lot of black South Africans, and I think blacks globally use Twitter. And it's become a medium for them to express their feelings and their anger and their hurt and what they think about the way some whites behave.
Now, I understand that today the ruling African National Congress Party plans to take legal action against this woman, and the Democratic Alliance Party, I understand, plans to expel her. Is that correct?
Well, the Democratic Alliance Party does plan to expel her. They've also filed charges against her. The African National Congress says it will file charges against her and others who have made racist comments on Twitter and other social media. And the South African Human Rights Commission has been asked to investigate and have said they will do so.
So why, after so many years, after multi-party, multi-racial democratic elections in South Africa, are racial tensions so high?
I think one of the causes is the fact that South African society remains deeply unequal. Many of the imbalances of society haven't been overcome. I also think people communicate much more easily these days through social media, and so it lends you a little bit of distance and sometimes even anonymity. And so people, you know, feel free to express their feelings and their hurt, and there's a growing global voice of black people speaking about whiteness, how they see it, and they say it is inherently racist. The feelings about race are much more openly and easily expressed and are much more in the public domain than what they were before. And I think that might be one of the reasons why it seems as though South Africa is far from the rainbow nation everybody hoped it would be.
That's reporter Delia Robertson from Johannesburg. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. While 2015 was a restive year in South African politics with a brawl in parliament, corruption scandals, protest over inequality and university fees, the political year even included a high-profile game of cat and mouse with a visiting president wanted for war crimes. The new year will throw all these issues into a hot crucible. Nationwide municipal elections in which analysts predict President Jacob Zuma's sliding popularity will hurt the ruling African National Congress. VOA's Anita Powell takes a look at the roller coaster ride ahead.
2015 was, by all accounts, an intense year on South Africa's political scene. The year kicked off with an actual fistfight in Parliament and ended in a rash of end-of-year marches calling for Jacob Zuma's removal. Analysts say 2016 could be even more significant when all of these issues get thrown into what is usually seen as a boring but necessary fixture of democracy, local elections. The major elections are likely to serve as a proxy war for the nation's bigger political battles and have major consequences for the next national polls in 2019. Political analyst Ralph Matega says the ruling African National Congress Party, which has ruled the country since 1994, has lost about 3% of the vote in every recent election. He says President Zuma is driving voters away from the ANC with his role in various scandals, such as the use of $20 million in government money to upgrade his private home, and his decision to go through three different finance ministers within the space of a week. Matega predicts the opposition Democratic Alliance and far-left economic freedom fighters will exploit ANC weaknesses in urban areas this year.
In some areas, that decline becomes sharp, radical, beyond that 3% because of the legitimacy crisis that the Jacob Zuma administration has encountered in its two terms. And that is accelerating this decline. It's accelerating what ought to happen, but it's just increasing the pace of what is not unexpected. Jacob Zuma is a liability when it comes to that. And the metros that we are talking about, your Tshwane, your city of Johannesburg, your Cape Town, your Nelson Mandela Bay.
Joy Copeland is an ANC councillor for a wealthy Johannesburg ward and says she's seeing that shift before her eyes. She says her two terms have been fulfilling, though she isn't running again for personal reasons, but that she knows voters in her area no longer support the ANC.
In the suburbs that I work in, it is a DA stronghold, and we don't see our chances of, we might increase our figures from previous, but we would not be able to overcome the DA majority.
She blames the change on racism. For example, she says Johannesburg's ANC mayor is pushing to add cheaper housing in the city's wealthier neighborhoods in hopes of making them more racially diverse. but her constituents are largely opposed to the idea, and therefore to the ANC. Former Johannesburg ward councillor Darren Bergman, now a DA member of parliament, disagrees. He says South Africans are upset at the ANC mainly because of failures at the local level, especially the failure to provide regular electricity, water, and basic services to everyone. Matega, the analyst, predicts this year will be the start of a shift in South Africa towards stronger local government. He says this scramble for local seats may cause some instability if the parties have to form local government coalitions, but says it's ultimately good for the country.
It's the most immediate form of democracy you find through local government. And I think that I see the future where local government becomes the basis for national politics in the long run. It's not going to happen anytime soon, but it is evolving in that direction.
South Africa's local elections begin in May and run through mid-August. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In news elsewhere, French President François Hollande today kicked off a week of commemorations marking Islamic extremist attacks in Paris that began with an assault on the satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo, a kosher market, and police a year ago this week claiming 17 lives. The January 7, 2015 attacks, dubbed France's 9/11, marked the start of a string of jihadist strikes in the country that culminated in the November 13th attacks in Paris that left 130 people dead. Victims' families joined Hollande and other dignitaries to unveil a plaque at Charlie Hebdo's former offices, where staff last year were holding an editorial meeting when two heavily armed brothers stormed in, killing 11 people. They then paid homage to a police officer killed as he tried to chase down the fleeing gunman. Spray painted on the sidewalk was a message of support for the Muslim officer, reading, "I am Ahmed," in the red, white, and blue of the French flag. Hollande later commemorated four people killed at a kosher supermarket in an attack that revived concerns about anti-Semitism in the country with Europe's largest Jewish community. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 27 minutes past the hour on the Voice of America.
Africa, this is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you on board. This is Upfront on the Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there is a youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A spokesman for Burundi's foreign minister says the government will not attend peace talks scheduled for tomorrow. And the bodies of 21 migrants have washed ashore today as boats capsized trying to reach the shores of the Greek island of Lesbos. 7 passengers were rescued. Coming up, we'll have music from Nigeria and our feature segment. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand reporter Michael Cariotti joins us again this evening from Zimbabwe.
Kim, this evening we bring you the second and final part of Michael Cariotti's look at Zimbabwean sport in 2015, a year that Michael says showed Zimbabwean sport was in crisis. And Michael begins with Zimbabwe cricket.
On the field of play, the Zimbabwe cricket team was the most disappointing. Zimbabwe finished sixth in their 7-team World Cup group after managing only one win in 6 games. That is not all. Whitewashes against Pakistan and Bangladesh and losses to associate sides like Afghanistan have also drawn the ire of the Minister of Sport and Recreation, Makosini Ntlongwane, who has asked for a change in results. The Zimbabwe Sevens rugby team also failed to qualify for the 2016 Rio Olympic Games after losing 17-19 to Kenya in the African qualifiers in Johannesburg. As if this was not enough, the Zimbabwe Davis Cup team led by Takanyi Garanganga failed to reach the Euro Africa Zone Group 2 stage after they were humiliated 5-0 by Bosnia-Herzegovina, for that matter, at their home of Harare Sports Club. The team, however, will take comfort in the fact that they retained their place in the Euro Africa Zone Group 3 after hammering Moldova 5-0 at the same venue. There was no joy, too, for FC Platinum, who were Zimbabwe's representatives in the CAF Confederation Cup. Norman Mapeza's side failed to reach the mid-league stage after they were eliminated in the second round 4-2 by Young Africans of Tanzania. As Zimbabweans reflect on what has been a bad sporting year gone by, it is also important that they also look forward to the future with renewed vigor and optimism. The year 2016 is an Olympic year. A number of Zimbabwean athletes, among them Kirsty Coventry, marathon runner Wurimai Juao, and rowers Michin Thorncroft and Peter Purcell-Gilpin have all qualified for the Olympic Games. Qualified too are the Mighty Warriors, who are looking forward to their romance with the biggest sporting event in the world. Zimbabwe too will be hosting the International Rugby Board Under-19 World Cup, for which not only a good show is expected from the Zimbabwean team, but a successful hosting of the tournament as well. There is also the Davis Cup Euro Africa Zone Group 3 tie against Finland, for which Zimbabwe should win to regain their lost respectability. That is not all. Zimbabwe will have 2 representatives in Pan-African football, Chicken Inn in the CAF Champions League and Harare City in the CAF Confederation Cup. Chicken Inn won the Kasolaga Premier Soccer League Championship, while Harare City took the Chibuku Super Cup. Both sides have the financial muscle to sustain a realistic challenge for the Pan-African titles. Manuti too will be going for probably the biggest fight of his life when he challenges Khan for that WBC silver belt. Should he win against Khan, that will bring him closer to a big money fight against American Floyd Mayweather.
Like I always say, for every fight, everybody had a game plan.
As of right now, there's not a blueprint on how to beat Floyd Mayweather. No one has found the way to break the Mayweather code.
Manucci has not rested during this festive period and has been in training for the fight against Khan.
I'm looking at to challenge Amir Khan WPC silver or to get WPC gold to Mayweather.
The Warriors are in camp preparing for the 2016 African Nations Championships to be held in Rwanda, and the same team too will be on the road at their first Swaziland, Guinea and Malawi in the qualifiers for the 2017 Africa Cup of Nations finals. The Minister of Sports and Recreation, Makosi Ntlongwane, has promised better government funding for Zimbabwe national teams in 2016.
We have Olympics. We have our boys that will be traveling to Rwanda. We need to find a way of assisting those projects.
That, however, appears to be coming a bit late after the Warriors were thrown out of the 2018 World Cup after failing to pay a paltry $67,000 owed to former coach Brazilian Valinos. Now that 2015 is gone, the focus should be on the year 2016, hoping that it will bring celebration to Zimbabwean sports lovers. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariati.
Sporty greetings.
If you would like to leave a voicemail for possible use on a future Sunny Side of Sports broadcast, please call 1-202-205-9942. Once again, that number, 1-202-205-9942. When you hear the VOA identification, press 60. And please include your name and where you are calling from.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Joining us now with a package of African football news is the VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Uganda will stage the 2016 Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's SECAFA Under-17 and Women's Championships. The SECAFA Secretary General Nicolas Musonye revealed in Khartoum, Sudan on Monday. Burundi is venue for this year's SECAFA Under-20 Championship. Zanzibar will stage the SECAFA Kagame Club Championship, while the region's flagship event, the SECAFA Senior Challenge Cup, takes place in the Sudan. Staying in Khartoum, newly elected SECAFA President Dr. Mutasim Gafar of Sudan unveiled a 5-year strategic plan with an emphasis on youth and women's football development. In this regard, SECAFA is entering an exchange program on youth development with Saudi Arabia Football Association. Gafar says they will overhaul the SECAFA statutes, taking into consideration the changing football environment. SECAFA's 12 member associations include Burundi, Eritrea, Ethiopia, Djibouti, Kenya, Rwanda, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, Tanzania mainland, Uganda, and Zanzibar. Meanwhile, Ghana will vote for a FIFA president who promises to increase Africa's slots at the FIFA World Cup, the Ghana Football Association president Kwesi Nyantigi told the Accra media. Africa has currently 5 slots at the 32-nation event. Nyantigi says he expects Africa to be granted 6 or 7 slots at the global contest. The Ghana football chief also wants to see an increase in Africa's representation on the FIFA executive committee. This is FIFA's highest decision-making body. Currently, Africa has 4 out of 23 members. Nyantigi's remarks come a week ahead of the West Africa Football Union WAFU Zone B General Assembly due in Accra. Nyantigi is also the WAFU Zone B president and seeks to drive his point home when the FIFA presidential election candidates converge in Accra next week seeking support. The WAFU Zone B member associations are Benin, Burkina Faso, Ivory Coast, Ghana, Niger, Nigeria and Togo. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. Tamina, mina, waka, waka, Tamina, mina, this time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited.
Hola.
Cause this is Africa. This time for Africa.
The Confederation of African Football, CAF, will hold its annual awards ceremony on Thursday evening in Abuja, Nigeria's political capital. The biggest prize to be handed out is the 2015 African Footballer of the Year Award. Manchester City man Yaya Toure is bidding for his record-extending fifth consecutive trophy. Cameroon's Samuel Eto'o also won four African Footballer of the Year awards, but he didn't do it in consecutive years like the rugged Ivorian Toure. The two other finalists for the award are Andre Ayew of Ghana and Swansea City and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang of Gabon and Borussia Dortmund. Meanwhile, the National Team of the Year for 2015 award looks to be very competitive. Ivory Coast, the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations champion, is one of five teams in contention, along with neighbor Ghana, the team it beat in a marathon penalty kick shootout in the final last February. Nigeria's national under-17 team, which won a record-extending fifth world title last year in Chile, is also a nominee for the award, as well as Mali's national under-17 team, which lost 2-0 to Nigeria in the FIFA under-17 World Cup final. And Nigeria's national under-23 team is also a nominee for the award. Nigeria won the under-23 Africa Cup of Nations tournament last month in Senegal. The Nigerian Dream Team, I think it's Dream Team 6, also clinched a berth at this year's Olympic men's football tournament in Brazil, as did runner-up Algeria and third-place finisher South Africa. And mark your calendars, VOA football fans. The opening ceremony for the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro is scheduled for August 5th. I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
And if you check out my Facebook page today, Tuesday, you'll see an article on Ghanaian fighter Richard Kami, who has won all 23 of his professional bouts with 21 knockouts. The 28-year-old Kami fights in the lightweight division, and he's scheduled to be in a final elimination bout for the IBF world title sometime in 2016. Richard Kami says he's one step closer to his dream of being a world champion and bringing the title belt home to Ghana. Richard Kami, an African fighter to watch in 2016. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, we continue our series on the global sexual exploitation of children. And more than 18 million people across Eastern Africa are at risk of food insecurity. First, here's some music. Here's Tosin of Nigeria with his live version of Down the River.
They go down the river, there they go down the river, there they go down the river, there they go in search of the money, in search of the fish, in search of the ring, in
search of the gold, in search of the princess, in search of the diamond, in search of the padaka, in search of everything,
never let go.
What you're looking for, never let go, never, never, never let go. Hey, yeah, yeah. See, you see, la 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 la, yeah, 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 they go down the river, there they go down the river, and there they go in search of the money, in search of the prince, in search of the ring, in search of the ring princess, in search of the prize, in search of the queen, in search of the mullah, in search of the gold.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Never let go.
Tosin with Down the River. Well, the world agrees on this much. The sexual exploitation of children through trafficking, abusive online images, forced marriages, and other practices are pervasive and a growing problem in Africa and elsewhere. But so far, there is no international consensus about the names used to identify them as crimes. Therefore, there is no agreement about what should be done to address them as crimes. Since 2014, an international coalition has worked to accurately define and address the sexual exploitation of children. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
The same words can mean different things in different places. They can even obscure rather than reveal the truth about a situation. And when it comes to the sexual exploitation of children, confusion over terms and their meanings can stigmatize victims of these abuses and can hamper international efforts to deal effectively with the problem.
And this is also something that's hugely important when it comes to international advocacy and developing international law and international policies that will protect children from these practices.
That's international lawyer and human rights expert Susanna Greyer. She's project coordinator for the Interagency Working Group on Terminology, a multinational effort with a long name and a clear mission to clarify the words associated with child sexual abuse and what they mean.
Words are extremely important because they really do affect how we think about problems, how we prioritize issues, or even if we're going to think of it as a problem or not.
Greer offers the term child pornography as an example.
Pornography today is something that's in many countries something legal, something quite normal. When you add, however, the term child to pornography, you end up with something that's not only illegal, but also potentially very stigmatizing and harmful, actually, to the child. It risks inadvertently normalizing something that is illegal. And here we have a strong, strong backing from law enforcement, increasingly so in many countries, but also at the international level from Interpol and Europol, who are taking a distance from this term and claiming that it needs to be stopped.
An emerging consensus within the Terminology Project recommends the phrase child sexual abuse material instead.
This is a term that covers much better what it is really about. This is about child sexual abuse.
Greyer says that other common terms like child prostitute and underage sex worker also carry stigma for young people, most of whom have been forced into sex work for the enrichment or pleasure of others. Those kids are victims, she says, not criminals. But because prostitution is often criminalized,
it puts the blame on a child who has been victim of something atrocious And it makes it more difficult for that child to speak out about what has happened, because there is a fear of being blamed, and that's something that we really have to and can work against, I think. We certainly have an issue also on the side of the offenders when we use this economic language, I should say, of client and customers. We tend to reduce the gravity of what's actually happening, of the crimes that are being committed. We are talking about sexual offenders.
Atlanta-based Darlene Rich works with the Access to Justice Project for ECPAT, a large non-governmental coalition of groups dedicated to ending the sexual exploitation of children for commercial purposes. She says that because few countries were willing to decriminalize prostitution per se, the phrase child prostitute drew little sympathy and help from law enforcement, at least in the United States.
When we started referring to them as trafficking victims, it changed everything. Their initial reaction was sympathy instead of condemnation. It was a complete change.
In Africa, defining the word child can be a complex legal and cultural matter. As a legal matter, the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child defines a child as anyone under the age of 18 without exception, and mandates that all children deserve special safeguards and protections. But as a cultural matter, the word child is often used for someone quite young, usually before the onset of his or her adolescence. The issue gets even more complex. While someone ceases to be a child only when they reach the age of 18, the age of sexual consent is younger than that in most countries. Susanna Greyer says it's often assumed that because a child can legally consent to sex, he or she can also agree to sex that is exploitative or abusive.
This is completely wrong. No child can ever consent to being sexually abused or exploited.
Sexual exploitation often occurs in the context of so-called child marriage, when a girl is married without her consent, frequently for purposes of sex, then divorced after a time to be married off once again to the highest bidder, who also uses her for sex. Here, the Terminology Project asserts that the word child marriage is misleading when it masks the fact that a girl has been forced into an arrangement which is inherently exploitative. Another seemingly benign example that masks a darker reality is with so-called child sex tourism, where people travel to places where children's bodies are sold for sex.
It's something that is sometimes being advertised online as something that you can do. It's something that's being banalized, so as in certain countries it's okay. It's something that can be adventurous or exotic. And there's a lot of cultural relativism involved here, especially in the sending countries such as Europe or the United States of America, which send a lot of tourists abroad, including persons who commit this crime. And when they go abroad, it seems like it's much less serious than if they would commit child sexual exploitation at home because of these sort of excuses that are being used.
Clearly, when it comes to the sexual exploitation of children, words do matter, both for the everyday people who use them without examining their implications and for the professionals who try to prevent those crimes, help victims, and prosecute offenders. Both groups welcome the Terminology Project's final report in 2016, which comes with a short guide of terms in English, French, and Spanish. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
The United Nations says more than 18 million people across eastern Africa are at risk of food insecurity due to El Nino weather patterns and conflicts in the region. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
The East African Bloc, IGAD, warned the persistent drought affecting eastern and central Africa will continue for at least 3 more months. IGAD Climate Prediction and Applications Center Director Guleid Artan says East African nations will receive more rainfall, but not until March.
The drought in the north sector will continue till the next rainy season, while the rains will subside in half of Kenya, but will have above average rainfall in southern western Kenya and Uganda, Tanzania, especially around the Great Lakes area.
El Niño, a climate phenomenon, occurs when temperatures in the central and eastern Pacific Ocean become warmer than average, causing a shift in atmospheric circulation. El Niño's impact was felt in eastern Africa as far back as early May, when drought conditions affected parts of Ethiopia, Sudan, and Somalia. According to Pete Manfield from the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, an estimated 18.5 million people are at risk of starvation due to drought and conflicts in the region.
There are a number of other conflict dynamics in the region which are new this year, which are adding quite a significant strain to the new humanitarian requirement, particularly conflicts in Burundi, South Sudan, and in Yemen. And this is requiring both a scale-up in short-term life-saving interventions.
The regional drought has hit Ethiopia especially hard, and the government there is appealing for $1.1 billion to help feed more than 10 million people. Neighboring South Sudan and Somalia both have internal strife on top of drought. United Nations World Food Programme spokeswoman Charles McDonough says the fighting makes it hard for aid agencies to reach those most in need of aid.
And then combined with that, we now have erratic rainfall and the harvests in some of the non-conflict areas that have been kind of the breadbasket of South Sudan are not as good as we would have hoped. I think in Somalia, you're facing similar combination of kind of conflict-related concerns.
An estimated 300,000 people across East Africa have been displaced from their homes due to the drought. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In response to the dramatic decline of lion populations in the wild, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently announced it will list two lion subspecies under the Endangered Species Act. The subspecies Panthera leoleo, located in India and Western and Central Africa, will be listed as endangered. Another subspecies, Panthera leomelanocaita, located in Eastern and Southern Africa, will be listed as threatened. To protect lions and other foreign and domestic wildlife from criminal activity, Service Director Dan Ash also issued a director's order to strengthen enforcement of wildlife permitting requirements. The order will ensure that violators of wildlife laws are not subsequently granted permits for future wildlife-related activities, including the import of sport-hunted trophies. In the last 20 years, lion populations have declined by 43% due to habitat loss, loss of prey base, and retaliatory killing of lions by a growing human population. Coupled with inadequate financial and other resources for countries to effectively manage protected areas, the impact on lions in the wild has been substantial. Through the director's order, the Fish and Wildlife Service is redoubling its efforts to ensure that the world's rarest species are protected from those who violate wildlife laws. Importing sport-hunted trophies and other wildlife or animal parts into the United States is a privilege, not a right, a privilege that violators of wildlife laws have demonstrated they do not deserve, said Ash. We are going to strengthen our efforts to ensure those individuals, people who have acted illegally to deprive our children of their wildlife heritage, are not rewarded by receipt of wildlife permits in the future. The service is also working to increase the fees it charges for these permit applications. The lion is one of the planet's most beloved species and an irreplaceable part of our shared global heritage, said Ash. If we want to ensure that healthy lion populations continue to roam the African savannas and forests of India, it's up to all of us, not just the people of Africa and India, to take action.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.